Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We also welcome our viewers on C-SPAN, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to present our speaker, Ian Fletcher. He is senior economist of the Coalition for a Prosperous America, a nationwide grassroots organization with over 2.5 million members, dedicated to fixing America's trade policies and comprising representatives from business, agriculture, and labor. He was previously research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industry Council, a Washington think tank founded in 1933, and before that, an economist in private practice serving mainly hedge funds and private equity firms. Educated at Columbia University and the University of Chicago, he lives in San Francisco. Ian Fletcher regularly writes blog posts about trade in popular online publications. His blogs can be read at the Huffington Post and WorldNet Daily. His most recent book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, was published in 2011 and is available for purchase here tonight. Mr. Fletcher will autograph copies. Let's give a warm welcome to fellow San Franciscan Ian Fletcher.
Hi. I'd like to begin by pointing out to everybody that America's trade deficit is $500 billion a year. The reason I start with that fact is just to make crystal clear that if we've got a trade problem in this country, that is to say, if our trade relations with the rest of the world are not in good order, it's a big problem. It's not a little problem. It's not an obscure little thing. We've all been sitting through weeks, if not months, of discussion of the so-called fiscal cliff. And if you look at how much money is involved there, this is a comparable amount of money. People have been worried that the fiscal cliff would result in a huge amount of aggregate demand, as economists call it, being taken out of our economy. Well, thanks to our trade deficit, we're looking at a comparable amount of money being taken out every year, regardless of what happens, and it's been going on for years and years and years. Now, some people don't understand what the trade deficit is. Some of you will. But the trade deficit is just the difference between what America exports and what we import. So what it really means to say that we're $500 billion out of balance with the rest of the world is that we're consuming more than we produce to the tune of $500 billion a year. And the reason that's true is the only place you can get goods to consume is you either make them yourself or you import them from someplace else. So this is yet another way in which the United States is living beyond its means. Now, those remarks were just to try and get you interested, though I do have to say people usually don't pay money to hear me speak, so I'm assuming you're all at least somewhat interested. If you're going to look at free trade, once you understand that there's an issue here with the trade situation, if any of you got a wallet on you, you might pull out a $10 bill, because you'll see the guy on the $10 bill is Alexander Hamilton, America's first Secretary of the Treasury, the intellectual architect of American capitalism, one of the founding fathers, and an avowed protectionist, as was Abraham Lincoln, as was virtually every president prior to World War II. Now, what this tells us is if we have a trade problem and we have this idea that free trade, you always hear that free trade is just taken for granted as a thing that's right, that's the best policy, et cetera, et cetera. Well, given that for most of American history, Americans did not believe in free trade, did not practice free trade, and during that era, I remind you, America was the most successful economy in the world. We have some provocation from economic history that maybe economic theory or what passes for it on the editorial page isn't correct. Because how could that be that the United States could have repudiated free trade for so long, been an avowedly protectionist country? Teddy Roosevelt, avowed protectionist. He viewed free trade as a form of moral degeneration for reasons I could talk about later. No, he did. He says, thank heavens I am not a free trader. It seems to coincide with a fatty degeneration of the moral fiber. I think what he meant there is that it's a kind of laissez-faire philosophy. It is, of course, free trade is the international application of the idea of laissez-faire, of purely free markets, of deregulate everything. Now, that's an idea that no developed country takes seriously domestically. The United States hasn't taken that idea seriously in our domestic economic policy for well over 100 years. There's some rhetoric from right-wing people that, okay, we believe in laissez-faire. If you look at what conservative presidents like Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or George W. Bush actually did in office and tried to do, nobody believes in it. And yet, suddenly, when you look at our international economic policy, we really do take this very strange theory that kind of died in the robber baron era, the 1890s, domestically, and suddenly we treat it like gospel truth. So another thing, just to wake you up, that maybe there's a real controversy here, and I harp on this because free trade is the received opinion that gets spooned out by almost all of the media, most of our political system. So it takes a little bit of stage setting here to hopefully get you guys to take the idea seriously that maybe, as I put in my book, free trade doesn't work. Now, here's an interesting thing. This is a translation of my book into Chinese. It was done in Taiwan. They're working on Korean right now. God knows what they had me say. I can't tell. Now, we have stuff translated. I have some friends here who've told me it's okay. But if you look at all the other successful economies in the world, whether you're looking at China, Japan, Germany, Greater Germany, it means Austria, Switzerland, so on and so forth, the rest of the world doesn't really believe in free trade. And these are the other successful economies in the world. These are the countries we're borrowing money from. They seem to have money right now to spare, and we don't. The reality is that the other major economies in the world, they either openly repudiate free trade. For example, the government of Beijing is very brazen about promoting its own exports, about limiting imports from foreign countries. And they have dozens, if not hundreds, of major policies that do this. And other countries that have more democratic political systems and less authoritarian forms of government, they do largely the same thing in a much more polite way. There's no question that Japan manages its trade, or that Germany and the Germanic countries of Europe manage their trade. They control what their imports are. They control what their exports are. And they're doing very well, and we're the ones who are borrowing money right now, and they're the ones who are lending it to us. The other countries that go our way and take seriously the idea that free trade is a known truth of economics are countries that are in very similar problems that we're in. For example, the UK is in more or less the same boat we are, and they're having the same problems we're having. So hopefully all these facts I've just put on the table here should make you realize that this consensus we have in this country that free trade is just a known good thing, that maybe there's a problem here. There was an article in the last issue of Harper's by Jeff Madrick, which is starting to question, wait a minute, is there a problem here? So what I want to say is, having looked at this in some depth, and I wrote my book because I got interested in the topic from work I'd done as an economist in private practice, and I went looking for a book that could really tell me, is free trade really best? Has anybody actually looked at this in a very long time? There was no such book, so I decided to write the book myself. What I discovered is that, for a start, the consensus in favor of free trade is largely a hologram projected by special interest groups, specifically U.S.-based multinational corporations, or referred to as American corporations. They're really not. And if you look at their own communications emitted under circumstances where they feel it's in their interest to say this, they're quite clear about the fact they don't care about the American national interest or the U.S. as opposed to any of the other countries where they produce goods and sell them. It's in their interests to promote this policy, so-called free trade. Now, when I say free trade, I mean it's free on America's part. There are very, very few restrictions on imports into the United States. globally speaking, this construct free trade is not really free trade. It's free trade on the part of the U.S., which is why I'm talking about it, and then it's managed trade on the part of the other major economies. But it's our belief in so-called free trade that allows them to manage their trade against us. And when you add up all their policies for their interests, well, that's where the $500 billion a year that I mentioned before, that's where that comes from. Now, U.S.-based multinationals find it very convenient to have access to the American market, to be able to produce anywhere they want in the world, and to sell here without any restrictions or without any responsibilities be imposed on them in return. So they promote this construct free trade. They both have the ability to push it through the power of lobbying and the dominance of institutions like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is very strong over the Republican Party and less strong but still real over the Democrats. And they also have the indirect influence of the intellectual establishment in this country, which is a structure composed of journalists and think tanks and universities and various other people who think and write and have an interlocking influence on public opinion. All these institutions are in various ways under the control or at least the influence of the large corporate interests. I have no interest in promoting some Marxist conspiracy theory here. But it's simply true that American media is dominated by fewer than half a dozen large conglomerates. That is documented and not denied. It is simply true that if you look at the economics departments of America's major universities, who runs these universities? Who's on their board of trustees? Who funds them? Okay? This is not a conspiracy theory. It's just a very basic reality that the money and the power are set up so that when you have interest groups that find so-called free trade in their interest, they have the ability to push the academic establishment and the public policy establishment and the journalists, both in print and television, to tell the world, to tell the public, to tell the voters that this is the right policy, whether or not it is. Now, one of the things I mention in my book is if you look at a poll done about 10 years ago of economists, you see that 93% of American economists are in favor of free trade with reservations. But only about 70% of them are prepared to endorse free trade without reservation. Now, what this raises in my head, as it should raise in yours, is the question is, what is a reservation? And what you discover when you scratch the surface of economics is that the consensus that free trade is just known to be a good thing all the time, that is not really what economists think. What economists think is that it's dangerous to tell the public anything else because you're just going to get some idiot populist form of protectionism shoved down the country's throat with no logic to it. And that would be a bad thing, so you're better off just telling people free trade is best. It's kind of like if you talk to economics, they always give you the free market answer. Economists know perfectly well that there are a lot of limits and caveats to the concept of free markets, which is why we don't live in an 1890s robber baron type economy anymore, and no country does. But they also know that it's very dangerous to allow people to think anything otherwise, so they tend to take a certain rhetoric in public talking to those they view as the uninitiated. But if you scratch the surface, you discover that there's this 30% gap in which, okay, with some reservations. Now, what does that mean? What it means is that they think, and then 30%, of course, would take the other side. But what you discover is that if you talk to economists who actually specialize in trade as a field, because economics, like other academic disciplines, is broken down into fields, you discover that people who are actually trade economists are much less dogmatic on the subject than people who are specialists in some other field or just generalists who are only telling you what they remember about trade economics when they're in grad school. And the other thing that I've discovered, which I find fascinating, is if you talk to people who specialize in international trade and teach at business schools, not economics department, you discover they're even less dogmatic about free trade. And the reason for this, I puzzled over this for a while, but the reason for this, I concluded, is if you teach purely academic economics, you can be indifferent to the fact that in economic life, there are winners and losers. Now, we all know this in our personal life, in our career, in our shopping expeditions. There are winners and losers. There are more advantageous and less advantageous outcomes for you, me, and the other guy. If you're a pure academic economist, you can shrug your shoulders at that. If you teach in a business school, well, then you have to tell people how to be the winner. So business school economists are much, much more realistic about the fact that if you're going to teach people how to conduct international trade, you have to be realistic about the fact that international trade barriers are there. You tell your students, if you want to import into the United States, there are very few restrictions, which is true. But if you want to export to some place like China or even some exquisitely polite but still conniving country like Germany or Austria, you need to know what the rules really are, because the rules are not what it says on paper that they are. We have this beautiful construct called the WTO, which says, oh, we all agree to have free trade with one another, all those countries, we're all going to have free trade. Most of the rest of the world understands that that's not quite a sham, but it's a kind of a gentleman's agreement to conduct managed trade in a relatively polite way. Most of the world, and those of you who are lawyers may understand this, does not take the letter of the law in either their domestic laws or their treaty law as seriously as the United States. So we actually observe our WTO commitments, and the rest of the world doesn't. If the United States tried to practice the kind of managed trade other countries practice under current law, you could go to a federal judge and you could sue the government, you could make them stop. That's not true in most of the rest of the world. The WTO doesn't have nuclear weapons. It can't make a country like China open its markets to the United States if the Chinese don't want to. And most of the rest of the world understands that. So anyway, getting back to my original point, if you teach economics to business school students, you have to tell people there are winners and losers in the game. And one of the things I discovered from talking to people who have businesses that operate internationally is that this is all treated as completely obvious. For example, one of the major steelmakers in the U.S., I know their CEO, and he says it's just a given there are some countries we can't operate in, we can't sell to. There are other countries you can operate in, but you have to put the plant there. And it's just understood that that's the reality of the game. Now, when I found that out, I thought, okay, if that's the reality, why doesn't the theory line up with the reality? Because I tell you, I'm a somewhat academically inclined person, so I hate it when people say, oh, okay, well, this is true in practice, but it's false in theory or whatever. It's like, no, you got the wrong theory. A theory is supposed to be a description of the world. So if you have some experience of how things work, but the theories doesn't line up with it, well, don't just give up on your theory. Just get the right theory. I discovered a number of things when I looked into that. The first thing is that the economics, which supposedly proves that free trade is best, it rests on a whole lot of unsupported assumptions. The problem with a lot of people when they try and criticize free trade economics is that on its own terms, if you grant the assumptions of these economic theories, it's true. That's why you can't critique it. If you grant its premises, the conclusions follow. But you got to dig out what the premises are. For example, most of the theory that you look at, they don't deal with trade deficits. They just assume that in a free market, we have this wonderful equilibrium, an equilibrium will be reached, and we'll have balanced trade. Sometimes they don't even make that an explicit assumption, but that's an assumption which is there, and it's very different if you don't. Why is it different when you don't have balanced trade? That is to say, you run a trade deficit. Very simple, because we're not trading with Santa Claus. We don't get stuff for free. When we import more than we export, okay, we don't just get given that stuff out of the goodness of the hearts of foreign nations. We have to give them something in exchange. And what we give in exchange is we go into debt to them or we sell off existing assets. It's like if you wanted to spend more than your income as an individual. You either got to rack up credit card debt or sell off unwanted junk on eBay. As a result, when the United States runs a trade deficit, we have a declining net worth. We owe more and we own less. We are poorer. That's just accounting. That's not even economics. And that's not even to mention the issues of when we buy goods produced abroad as opposed to produced here, it destroys jobs because jobs are created overseas where these goods are produced as opposed to created here. It's no accident that our economy is having such a hard time recovering. Part of that is due to the overhang of debt and deleveraging, but part of that is due to the fact that you have $500 billion a year of demand that is just going overseas. There are other issues with the economic theory behind free trade. Those of you who studied economics in school or are familiar with the issue may have heard of something called the theory of comparative advantage. Okay? It's a theory that was invented in 1817 by a man called David Ricardo, who was a British stockbroker and a member of parliament who became an economist after reading Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations on vacation. And this theory has been around since then, and on its own terms, the theory is valid. Now, I spent an entire chapter in this book explaining what the problems with this theory are. There are a number of them. Some of them get a little bit technical. Trade deficit is one of the problems because you're assuming that your trade position can go on forever. Another issue, big issue with comparative advantage, is the problem that trade moves the goalposts. Okay, what I mean by that is the theory of comparative advantage, even if you take it as 100% true, which it isn't, but even if you buy it 100%, all it is it's a theory about what is the best swap to make for this stuff versus that stuff right here, right now. It completely ignores, does not have anything to say about how trade will affect the industrial and economic structure of a country. Now, what I mean by that is, if we buy, for example, automobiles from Japan or we buy aircraft parts from China, this doesn't only mean that we get goods today for less money than we might have paid to produce them ourselves. It also affects our economic base. It means that their industries will grow and strengthen in the future. It means ours won't. And this is a very significant cumulative effect. If you look at the effect of our trade deficit on economic growth, we've been running deficits since 1975. We've been running horrendous deficits since about 1990. If you add up the cumulative loss of economic growth due to those deficits, you're looking at something that's been calculated to be about 13% of the U.S. economy. So that's the size of the entire Canadian economy that's just not there, that probably would have been there if we'd had balanced trade. So when you look at all our economic problems, all this federal budget stuff, all these cuts that people are talking about to programs we don't want cut, or the fact that the United States is not going to buy this many fighter planes or any of this stuff, well, that traces back to trade because we have less tax revenue because we have less economy. We have less income because we have less economy. And it's a relentless cumulative effect, which is a problem that's entirely ignored by simply looking at the theory of comparative advantage. I mentioned fighter planes for a second. Let me just point one other thing out. I am primarily concerned with the economic implications of the free trade issue. There are a lot of non-economic implications. For example, the United States today is unable to put a single military aircraft into the air without using components made by potential adversaries. And I gave a talk at National Defense University at Fort McNair in Washington 3 years ago, and they said, yeah, we kind of know that, but the defense contractors control Congress and nobody cares. And I'm like, okay, I'm not actually a defense guy. This is, you know, talk to a bunch of military officers. You guys worry about it. Now, if you don't mind the idea of the U.S. being dependent for its defense on a hostile nuclear-armed dictatorship, go ahead. But I think there's some kind of problem there. You probably want to talk to somebody else about it. But that's part of free trade. Other nations manage this stuff. The U.S. historically, prior to the end of the Cold War, had some controls on this stuff because we understood that you need an industrial base not only for economic reasons but also for security. Now, interestingly enough, this ties back into American history because I mentioned Alexander Hamilton before. One of the reasons that Alexander Hamilton became a protectionist, and he was the lone economist among the founding fathers. He's really the guy who turned this country in that direction. He talked to General Washington and said to him, look, if we just have free trade in this new country that we're putting together, and they knew what free trade was. It was a policy option. It was controversial. They didn't talk about it in quite the same vocabulary in the late 18th century, but they knew what. They knew they had choices. Hamilton said, look, we're just going to end up as an economic dependency of Europe, because at the time the United States was an almost entirely agricultural society with minimal manufacturing, and the great industrial powers were all in Europe, particularly the UK, who we just fought a war of independence against. So Hamilton said, we can't be dependent on these people, so we need to have a protectionist policy. Now, the interesting thing is that it's not just an issue of national defense, because what you discover if you look into the history, and by the way, the history of this really goes back to the Renaissance. The economics of free trade and protectionism first emerged under rational discussion in the Italian Renaissance between the different Italian city-states, Florence, Venice, and so forth. There's kind of a myth out there that economics began with Adam Smith. It's really not true. But what you discover, if you look back 500 years of this history, you discover that every economically developed nation got that way practicing some kind of protectionism, not just the United States, but also the other developed colonial countries like Canada, Australia, even South Africa, strangely enough. And then you turn back Europe, the first industrialized countries. The UK turned very aggressively towards free trade in the mid-19th century. But prior to that, they had been one of the most protectionist countries in Europe. Now, the name for this policy is mercantilism, which is a phrase you may have heard if you have crossed paths with economic history at any point. There's a myth out there promoted by free traders and laissez-faire types that mercantilism was just about kings who wanted to hoard barrels of gold in the basement of the palace. That's not what it was about, though I do have to observe that having a lot of gold is the only way to expand the money supply when your financial system is based on gold. So hoarding gold is not these people were dumb and greedy. The gold is your money supply. So we talk about expanding the money supply with the Fed. Well, that's what they were trying to do. That's why they wanted a lot of gold. Mercantilism was a systematic philosophy, and it goes back 500 years, of how to manipulate the free market to develop your country, because laissez-faire will not do it. It never has done it. I don't know of any country that has gone from being a third world country to being a first world country under laissez-faire. And remember that all countries were third world countries at one time. The U.S. at the time of the American Revolution was considerably more primitive than Bangladesh is today. So every country, you have a counterexample to this myth that free trade is best. So the question that naturally provokes is, why did we change our minds? Why did we go from the protectionist policy of Teddy Roosevelt around 1900 to the free trade that we embraced after World War II? And the answer is, it wasn't an economic decision. You see, when I first realized that there was a switch, I said, okay, I want to trace this thing down to figure exactly who changed their mind, when, why, and how they persuaded everybody else. And you know what I discovered? It never happened, because it wasn't an economic decision at all. It was a political decision to win the Cold War. In 1945, 46, 47, the era of the Marshall Plan, the era of us figuring out what we've got to do with Europe so they don't go fascist again or don't go communist again. We said, okay, we've got to build up their economies, among other things. Okay, we've got to shoot a lot of bad guys. you know, they put Nazis on trial, they kick communists out of trade unions. And the other thing we got to do is we got to build up their economy so these people won't be so poor, because when people are poor and they have unemployment, et cetera, they do this politically crazy stuff. So do two things. One, we're going to throw our markets open to the world so that they can build up their economies through exports to us. And we're also going to encourage the export of American technology on the cheap. That's a whole other story that's out there. And the other thing it's going to do is it's going to tie them to dependence on us. Now, what that means is if you look at some country that looked in the 1950s like they might be possibly go communist, like Italy, it means we're in a position to say to the Italians and their trade unions, if you get too cute with the Reds, we cut off your shoe exports and you got 30% unemployment in Turin in 6 months. That's part of the game. It's to make these people rich, but also make them dependent on the American market so we can cut them off if they make trouble. And that's what Harry Truman and Dean Acheson, these guys, were about. That's what they were doing. And the U.S. was so incredibly economically strong in this era. I mean, U.S. GDP as a percent of world economic output peaked at about 51% of the world in 1945. So the idea of worrying about anybody else competing with us, about worrying about losing out to anyone else, is ridiculous at that point. We are worried about the rest of the world going communist or fascist. So that's why the decision was taken. And then that became the game plan for the Cold War generally. If you act nice towards the United States, you get access to our markets. If you really brass us off, like Cuba, you know, we put an embargo on you. Obviously, that's not the only thing we did, but it is definitely a part of the Cold War game plan going on till 1989, that you have this assumption of you open your markets to the rest of the world. Now, the problem is this gets entrenched because it's very convenient to U.S.-based multinationals once this policy is in place. People forget why we established the policy. Once you've made this policy, you have to start rationalizing it and tell people all sorts of things about what economics says that it really doesn't. So you make a decision like that, and like a lot of political and economic decisions, you can make a choice for one reason, and it can become entrenched, intellectually entrenched in the interest groups, and then you can be stuck with it. So the question then is, okay, what do we do about it? Now, thankfully, we've got a lot of leeway here. The first thing I think the United States needs to do is focus on the trade deficit. There's a lot more to it, but the short answer is you want to zero out your trade deficit. And how you get tough on the rest of the world, it's not that difficult to do if you make the decision to do it. The U.S. has a lot of discretion. Nobody has the power over us. They can stop us from doing what they're doing. And we have a lot of options. You can manage your trade by managing either trade or the countervailing capital flows that have to take place when trade is paid for. Because, as I pointed out, when you run a trade deficit, you're selling off assets and going into debt to foreign nations. So if you put in place capital controls, well, then that can't happen, and that will force your trade back into balance. The advantage of that is there's less legal infrastructure that you would have to remake because we have fewer legal commitments on that. But you can do it. If you look at what the rest of the world does with itself, with other countries, people understand what the game is. There would be squealing, there would be hollering, but fundamentally, the rest of the world would have to put up with that if that's what we chose to do. And in some ways, they would be relieved because they know that the current U.S. situation is unsustainable. You can't run up your credit card debt forever. You can't sell off existing assets forever unless you have an infinite supply of assets. At some point, the current situation is going to unwind. Whether it's going to unwind with a crisis that's just going to be all over the headlines one day, or whether it's going to unwind gradually, I don't know. And anyone who claims to know, I'd like to know on what grounds they predict. But the world is not going to give us stuff we don't pay for forever. What would that look like? Well, the obvious thing it looks like is a crash in the international value of the U.S. dollar. It's because the U.S. dollar is so high that we import so much stuff. Obviously, with a strong dollar, imports are cheaper and exports are more expensive. So if your dollar is overvalued, you will end up with a trade imbalance. Now, some of you may have heard of the issue of Chinese currency manipulation. Occasionally you see that in the press. It's one of the things that the organization I work for, Coalition for Prosperous America, has been working on for some time. And the strange thing about Chinese currency manipulation is that the Treasury Department refuses to designate China as a currency manipulator, which is an official action which the law requires them to do or not do, despite the fact that the Treasury Department's own economists have repeatedly concluded that China is manipulating its currency. There's not really any serious controversy over whether they do or whether they don't. There are some mischievous websites, magazines even out there that try and make a controversy out of this. The Chinese don't deny it, okay, is what I was told by a guy I know at the Taiwanese embassy who says, Ian, this is a silly controversy. If you read Chinese, they don't even deny it. It's not a real dispute. So how do you manipulate your currency? Well, the value of a currency, and remember, value of currency is very important because that's what you buy and sell stuff in. So if you manipulate the value of your currency, you can manipulate all your trade, which is trillions of dollars a year. The price of currencies is determined like anything else in a market. By supply and demand for the currency. So when you buy things from Americans, you demand dollars because that's what Americans accept. When you buy things from the Chinese, you demand renminbi because that's what they accept. So you can manipulate your currency if you create barriers to imports so that the Chinese buy fewer stuff from America than they otherwise would. You can also manipulate your currency. One of the things you do is all these dollars have to come back to the United States, that we send them. Okay, you got to do something with money. You can't just sit on it. You don't get anything. And we would like that money to come back to us by buying goods and services, but it doesn't. The Chinese government buys and has been buying treasury bills, treasury bonds, and so on and so forth, and increasingly some other stuff. They've accumulated preposterous foreign currency reserves, or they're not literally reserves of cash for the most part. They're reserves of liquid instruments. They have now something like $2,000 per person in China, and that's a lot of money for a third world country. So there's no question that they're manipulating their currency. One of the first things that the Obama administration could, should, and won't do is have its Treasury Department, which is an executive agency, designate China a currency manipulator so that the U.S. can start taking countermeasures against it. There was a bill to crack down on foreign currency manipulation that was passed a few years ago in the House and the Senate, but it was passed in separate sessions, so it didn't become law. That is one of the immediate things people ask, what could one do? But the larger issue is the U.S. simply has to get wise to the fact that free trade is a theoretical construct built on sand. It does not correspond with the real world. And its consequences, which are observable, are bad and they are inexorable. If anybody has questions, I'll take them now.
I think now, yes, sorry. And we'd like to remind our viewing audience that this is a program at the Commonwealth Club of California, Why Free Trade Doesn't Work, so that your questions will be recorded and included in our telecast. Please use the microphone, which I will now.
Thank you, Ian. A very spirited talk. I have a question from a non-economic perspective. And I wanted to say the Constitution of the United States says the President shall have the power by the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties provided two-thirds of the Senate concur. Now, all these free trade treaties, except for the Canadian one, U.S.-Canadian one in 1988, have passed by simple majorities. Okay, now, I don't remember a constitutional amendment, you know, allowing the president and the government to do this, how were they able to get these things through legally?
Well, you've touched on a much larger topic I should talk about, which is that free trade is a problem, and then free trade agreements are a problem in their own right. The big issue with free trade agreements is not just that they mandate free trade for the U.S. and not really for the rest of the world. The big issue is that they have a whole lot of other provisions in them. I mean, 90% of the text of most of these agreements has nothing to do with trade. It's primarily about protecting the rights of foreign investors. This is a problem both in the U.S. and in other countries, because what it means is you have treaty commitments that say basically you've agreed to certain policies and you've given up your democratic right to make, say, environmental policy, worker safety policy, consumer safety, and a lot of other things. Environment are the big ones. Because if you make some change that impairs somebody else's profitability, well, that's lumped into the same category as a bunch of Marxist bandits riding down from the mountains and stealing everybody's stuff. In principle, the idea is to protect foreign investors from expropriation. What it's become is it's become a way of cementing in place policies that may not be the best policies and which are also, it's profoundly anti-democratic. With respect to your specific legal question, you'll have to ask a lawyer. I do know that treaty law is the supreme law of the land in the United States under the Constitution, and that is problematic because when the Constitution was written, it was not expected that treaties would have a whole heck of a lot to do with the domestic policy issues of a country. So right now, you have the ability to use treaty laws to get around the inability to pass certain provisions that would never make it through the House and the Senate. But if you sign a treaty that says we must do X, then you have a commitment.
Okay, well, these are called free trade agreements, okay? But they're treaties, are they not?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you.
Very well.
Hello, Mr. Fletcher. You mentioned early in your talk that other countries have de facto restrictions on trade or management of trade. Let me narrow it down a little bit. Can you discuss how, let's say, Northern European countries manage their trade in ways that we, the United States, don't?
Let me just begin with a slightly more entertaining example, as pointed out to me. In South Korea, if you buy a foreign car, everybody knows what happens is you get a tax audit by the Korean equivalent of the IRS. So Korea, in terms of the spectrum of China, which is just blatant, to some of these other countries, which are more subtle, is somewhere in the middle. Okay, I'll give you an example. You mentioned Northern Europe, and the key thing to understand is if you look at the intellectual and the policy history of this issue, I use the term Greater Germany, which basically means Germany and a host of smaller countries that follow German economic policy, Austria, Switzerland, Holland, Denmark, Scandinavia. Here's an example. In Germany, one of the things they have that we don't is their corporate structure is much more dependent on debt as opposed to equity. That is bank finance as opposed to stock market finance. And what this means is you have giant so-called universal banks there that own a large proportion of their major corporations. So if you have BMW, for example, deciding, no, we're not going to buy our carburetors from this German manufacturer that's been supplying us for 30 years. We're going to buy them from this company in Texas or England or South Korea, wherever. They are going to get a call from their bankers and say, look, you idiot, if you cut these guys off, they'll go broke or they won't be able to pay the money they owe us. So if you ever want to get trade credit at a decent rate again, you're not going to do that. Now, obviously, when you have a system that's set up that way, nobody has to make that phone call. It's just understood that There are people you're supposed to do business with and people you're not supposed to do business with. And it's still a capitalist country. It's not a command economy. There are limits as to how incompetent people can get and still expect to be in the club, which is why there's a lot of internal pressure. Everybody's got to be good at what they do so we can all do business inside the club and still remain profitable and so forth. But that's just one of the more polite examples of what's sometimes called crony capitalism, which is a terrible term, but I use it because people understand it. Sometimes crony capitalism in countries like Malaysia and Indonesia is just a bunch of rich, greedy, incompetent people scratching each other's back. In the more civilized, polite countries, the masters of this being Germany and Japan and the countries that follow after them, like Korea and Taiwan, all these countries have their different arrangements. But the pattern is that you do have a clubby corporate establishment, and the government understands the game. The government wants to favor domestic producers. They understand that they've got to be competent. You could do that. So they push people very hard. But there is an assumption of insiders and outsiders, and that assumption is just so imbued in the system that nobody really has to talk about it very much. But if you go talk to people under the right, in the right time, in the right place, nobody denies this because they say, look, it works very well for us. It's good for the country. Why? What are we being ashamed of? Please.
So forgive my economic naivete, but you mentioned at the beginning of the talk that one of the issues with economics or economists speaking to the hoi polloi is they say something as rhetoric, like free trade is good, because they don't want someone instantiating bad trade restrictions, right? So you can imagine that in the same way that you've said that the dogma of free trade has free-floated off of the political underpinnings on which it was founded in the Cold War, that something like the old boys club, we don't do business with them, could also free-float away from that. So how do you, from a systems standpoint, deal with the externality of, you know, reduced domestic production and all of that going overseas in a way that doesn't just entrench other bad ideologies domestically? Like, I wouldn't want to have a dogma of, well, we don't buy Korean cars floating in America.
That's a good question, because you can't look at this issue without realizing that solving it is going to involve doing things which carry certain risks. And for many years, that's a standard answer when people admit that we have a problem. It's like, yeah, but doing anything about it would make things even worse. I absolutely agree with you that the solutions have been applied by a lot of foreign countries, which are very different politically and economically than we are probably not appropriate for us. But if you look at the rest of the world, they have their own diverse solutions among themselves. There's a common pattern in terms of balancing their trade, running trade surpluses, particularly against the biggest sucker on the block, Uncle Sam. But the ways in which they do this are very different. In my book, I talk about one thing you could do is if you just apply a flat tariff on U.S. imports. That's one way to push our trade back into balance that doesn't involve risks of crony capitalism, that doesn't involve risks of the government micromanaging the economy. If you just said, okay, we're just going to have a flat tariff of 10% or 20% or 30% or whatever it takes to get to a zero trade deficit, that doesn't introduce a lot of corruption or a lot of dangers of bad policymaking because it's a very simple policy. It's just determined by an arithmetical formula, and there's really no opportunity for anybody to play games. One of the good things about it, if you had a flat tariff, is if you had, say, a 30% tariff on imported goods, that's not enough to relocate the production of T-shirts back to the United States because foreign labor cost advantage is too great. It is very likely to relocate back to the United States things like silicon wafer fabrication. So it would tend to relocate back to the U.S. high-value, capital-intensive, skill-intensive industries, which is, of course, what we want to do. Those are the industries that a high-quality economy wants to have. Those are the industries you don't want to lose. And I point that out just to point out that if you do get serious about protectionism, protectionism has a logic to it, which if you understand what that logic is, I think it would be possible for the U.S. to make a winner out of this. Whether we should actually go in that direction is another question, but the possibility, I think, is definitely there. I think you can't dismiss this as infeasible.
I have two questions. My first question is, my recollection is that both William Grider and Jerry Mander have written books critiquing free trade, and I was wondering how your book differs from theirs. And my other question is, I remember years ago attending a conference on free trade, and one of the things they talked about was the other side. For example, a lot of people in this country are concerned about immigration from Mexico, and what most Americans don't realize is the reason why there are so many people coming here from Mexico is because our cheap agricultural imports or exports from our country, from the perspective of our country, are forcing Mexicans off the land because they're not able to make a living as farmers. And I was wondering if your book delved into issues such as that.
Yeah, I do talk about that. Obviously, when I'm talking to an American audience, and I deal mainly with the issues it presents for us, but free trade's not really been a good policy for any country. The specific problem you're talking about there is after NAFTA, there was a surge in American corn exports to Mexico, and we produce corn on these giant mechanized farms. We can produce it a lot cheaper than Mexican peasant farmers using hand tools, et cetera, et cetera. So you lower the price of corn, so it's cheaper food for people in Mexico, which is presumably a good thing, but you also make it impossible for a lot of people to stay in business doing this. They can't go and make silicon chips overnight, which is kind of the part of the myth of free trade economics and free market economics, is that if you destroy jobs, a replacement will just appear. When you have people of little education with fairly fixed circumstances, well, if you take their livelihood away, they don't have a lot of options. So, sure, there are a lot of problems with, you know, what free trade can do to third world countries. One issue, big issue, is when you have weak property rights. If you have somebody who's a farmer, and one of the defining characteristics of third world countries, of course, is that a majority of their population, or close to it, are still subsistence farmers, people who don't work in a factory or a store. They grow their own food to live. When you have people like this in a relatively isolated economy, they may be left alone by the powerful economic interests in their country because nobody really cares what they do. When you open these countries up to the rest of the world, so you massively open them up for both exports and imports, to put it bluntly, the fat cats in this country start stealing people's land to grow export crops, and these people starve or they have to go work as landless agricultural laborers. That ties into a whole lot of issues that are not in my field of expertise. But, yes, I do talk in my book about how the exposure, particularly the sudden exposure of primitive economies to the full force of the global economy, can be very destructive. And, of course, corruption and outright illegality and political problems in these countries only makes it worse. But, yes, free trade can definitely be a part of that. There's no question.
Ian, I really enjoyed your presentation. Thank you very much. I think you opened my eyes to a couple of things. I lived in Washington for a number of years and belonged to a club that was at H and 17th. And we saw guys like Greg Casey and Bruce Johnston in on a regular basis making their presentations. And I used to have lunch on Fridays, at least once a month, with a fellow by the name of Phil Merrill. And I'm sure you knew Phil. And when I got to town, this business of trade deficits just made me crazy. I just thought this was, I mean, how could we continue this on and on and on? And Phil was president of the Ex-Im Bank at that time, U.S. Export-Import Bank. And so I'd say to Phil, tell me why trade deficits are good. And his explanation was very interesting, and I'd be interested in your assessment of it. He goes back to the 1980s, where Congress became less than anxious to do any kind of country aid, any kind of foreign aid. And so the bureaucrats, the feds, developed these mechanisms for having funds available for the president to use. And one of them is this trade deficit, and which, in his opinion, was, in fact, foreign aid, very deliberately done, managed, and run by the bureaucracy. Interested in your opinion on that.
Yeah, that's pretty obviously true. I mean, most recently we increased Pakistan's textile quota to get them to cooperate with us on Afghanistan. That's ending a little bit just because we've opened the market so much now that there's not much left to give away because we've just conceded it all already. But as I said, that was the Cold War playbook. America's diplomats have for a very long time been remarkably ignorant of and indifferent to economic concerns. It's really remarkable. I mean, I read sometimes left-wing authors who think that America's foreign policy is this scheming economic thing to grab every spare penny anywhere to be found in the world. I mean, that's implemented by certain aspects of our policy, but the State Department and our diplomats generally are quite insouciant about this stuff. They assume America has the strongest economy in the world, always will have. The U.S. doesn't even maintain serious commercial services the way foreign countries do to promote our exports abroad. I mean, they sort of do, but there's no comparison to other nations which view protecting their export interests as a key goal of their diplomats abroad. So, yeah, I mean, you're basically right on that.
Hi, I am Fletcher. It's nice to see you. My question is concerning about foreign direct investment. So in her book, Winner Take All, a proficient economist, Dambisa Samoyo, claimed that between 1988 to 2008, U.S. government rejected nearly 2,000 proposal application for foreign firm to run business in the United States. So as you know that foreign direct investment can create job, and the government also can get more tax revenue. So do you support foreign direct investment or against it? So what do you think about it? Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. The standing institution of the U.S. government for vetting issues of foreign investment is called CFIUS. It's called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. And its record is public. You can download it off the internet. The fact is that the U.S. rejects very few applications for foreign direct investment. Most foreign direct investment is not even large enough to fall under their purview. They reject stuff that deals with very sensitive military technologies, stuff like that. For the most part, our investment market is just about the most open in the world. I don't think that quantitatively, if you look at the numbers, I don't think you can quantitatively make any non-laughable case that the United States is closed to foreign investment. The question of whether I view foreign investment as a good or a bad thing, what I got to tell you is this. When you're looking at foreign investment in the U.S., what it means is somebody else has dollars. Okay, they have wealth, and they're choosing to buy shares in some American corporation or invest in putting together some business in the U.S. Now, if you're looking at that as an alternative to buying goods and services from the U.S., which is what you are looking at when the U.S. is running a trade deficit, you're looking at a bad thing. It's not that foreign investment itself is bad, but the issue is not whether you have job-creating investment in somebody putting up money to build a hotel in Newport Beach, okay? The issue is not whether you have the investment or don't. The issue, if you frame it correctly, is whether the investment is made by Americans or foreigners, okay? Because most investments which are profitable and feasible, somebody is going to want to do that in a market economy like the U.S. The issue is whether the owners of those investments are going to be American or foreign. Now, when you run a huge trade deficit, you either have to borrow money or sell off assets, right? The accounting mandates it. So that when you have a huge trade deficit, yes, you're inevitably going to have a lot of foreign investment in the country. So from one point of view, that looks like it's a good thing. But you've got to remember is that that's simply the flip side of the trade deficit, because it means that when we import more than we export, we have to give foreigners something in exchange for all their stuff. So instead of sending them back goods, we give them assets. So that's why You know, you have Australians end up owning hotels in Chicago, and insurance companies in Vienna end up owning 10% of, you know, this company in Silicon Valley or whatever. So foreign investment, it can be good or bad, but you do need to understand that the accumulation of foreign claims on the U.S. means that they own stuff. We don't own stuff. It means their net worth is larger. Ours is less. So it's not a bad thing, but it reflects a bad condition that we've allowed to have happen. Does that make sense?
I begin by saying I'm a retired political scientist. And, of course, we always ask why the economists don't think about the politics of it enough. And so I will ask that kind of a question, because it seems to me that you've shown very well, and I've enjoyed it very much and learned a lot, but it seems to me that what you have shown is that fair trade does work for certain people, and even for certain Americans who happen to be involved with this elite group that is maintaining it in position. And yet, at the same time, you've shown that it is bad for the United States and its economy in general because of the growing deficits, threat to the quality of our dollar and so forth, but also to the individual people who are losing jobs. You are taking a very, as is your job, I can tell by the name of your organization, a very American position, but I wonder if even within those confines of not worrying that much about what it's doing to other people who in the global economy, even if we do focus on this, how would we do it? What would be the avenue for political action? Do you think you're promoting adequate political action? You've taken that into consideration enough, and maybe you have. I'm not saying you haven't. Simply by making lectures like this and writing books like this? Or do you have, or does your organization have, some other ideas for how to stimulate political action that would create government change that would address some of the problems you're talking about?
We are both, Coalition for Prosperous America is both a think tank and a lobbying organization. So we lobby on Capitol Hill. I fly to Washington a couple of times a year for that purpose myself. I can tell you that public opinion is with us both on the Democratic and the Republican side. The Congress is not yet with us, and I can't claim that it's easy going. I do think, as I mentioned before, that our hand is going to be forced at some point because the prison situation is unsustainable. There are signs all the time of people starting to wake up, but you're not talking about, as I like to say, this is not a merely billion-dollar problem. You're talking about U.S. trade is trillions of dollars a year, so it's a very big thing that we're working on. So it would not be reasonable to expect it to be easy.
That was a good to concluding question. Thank you for all your well-thought-out questions. We also thank our audience here and on C-SPAN, and of course, special thanks to our speaker for his provocative and thought-provoking talk. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.